Welcome to the Break Your Bullshit Box podcast, where excuses aren't tolerated and results are earned through authenticity, vulnerability, and a commitment to excellence. My name is Amber Furman, success architect, attorney, and NLP trainer. If you're ready to bitch slap the bully in your brain, overcome the bullshit that holds you back, and design the life and success you've always wanted, then it's time for you to break your bullshit box and step into designing life and success on your terms. Welcome back to another episode of the Break Your Bullshit Box podcast. Today we have Jamie Lima on the show. Jamie is a certified financial planner and a certified divorce financial analyst, which was an interesting concept for me to be introduced to. And I got to tell you, I'm kind of digging it. He has almost 20 years of financial planner experience. He is the founder of Woodson Wealth Management and Allegiant Divorce Solutions. And we really dug into the conversation of how to pick a good financial planner, what the importance is of having it, and how Jamie's background really led to him having this passion for helping people that are trying to figure out how to best split their assets in such an emotional time, such as a divorce. We had an absolutely fantastic time, and I'm looking forward to sharing the episode with you. Without further ado, let's jump into this interview with Jamie. Jamie, thank you so much for coming on the show with me today. I am so excited to dig into this conversation.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when we start to dig into the financial industry, I know that's where you're at now. We talked a little bit in the bio that you spent some time with Morgan Stanley, and now you spend some time in the wonderful world of couples with the certified divorce financial analyst, which God bless you, because anything related to couples and divorce and marriage and love is painful. What led you into this field? Were you one of those kids that always knew you wanted to deal with numbers, or did this happen some accidental way?
It was mostly accidental. I mean, I've made a few stops along the way to get to where I am. I worked with some big name firms, but what really led me to this type of work, frankly, and I've told the story before, so I feel like I'm repeating myself, but your listeners have not heard this story. Where it really stemmed from is when my parents were very young when they got married, and I was about seven or eight years old, I think, when they got divorced, early on in their marriage. And I remember, you know, my parents were hardworking, blue collar people, you know, and just really, really struggled, frankly, to make ends meet. You know, like my dad had to go from, you know, putting food on the table and a roof over the heads of one household to now having to do it for two. My mom was working multiple jobs just to make ends meet for us. And I remember there was a particular point in time when one of my best friends growing up, and he's still one of my great friends today, he and his mother brought over a box of groceries and filled our pantry for us because there was no money, right? And I remember, even though I was that young, remembering like, wow, this is really challenging. And it put some strain on me and some stress on me early on. And I told myself, even though I was 7 or 8 years old, that I was going to do whatever I could in my own life one day when I had kids to ensure that they never had to have those same experiences. And I think that's really what, you know, how I gravitated towards learning about investments and business and so on, because, you know, it's like anything else. You know, if you don't have that thing, you know, if whether it's love or money or whatever it is, you tend to seek it out, right? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't a great student, you know, going through high school and what have you, but once I got into college, I really buckled down and really focused on this line of work. And I had an opportunity to join a company called Morgan Stanley early on, and they gave me a shot to give myself a opportunity to get my foot in the door. And then I went to Fidelity Investments a few years later and continued to grow my career and got to the point where I was coaching and training financial advisors. And now I run a financial advisory firm, and I also have a specialization in divorce.
I love all of that for you. And I
I emphasize the for you part of that because you have numbers and couples, the two things that I have worked my entire career to avoid. So you have combined them and somebody needs to. So I have a friend that practices family law, and every time she gets up and talks about how much she loves her career, I'm like, my God, are you like narcissistic? That's insane. But I also know you get to make a huge impact in it, which is incredible. So
that's the biggest takeaway from it. It is very challenging. It's very emotional, sometimes very stressful work, but you know, when you see people get through it and they're on the other side and they're in a much better financial position, that's the holy grail right there.
Absolutely. You told this story about this experience that you had just knowing that other people were helping and supporting you, and that was helpful to you and also a driving force. Did your were your parents open about your financial situation, or was it your own experiences that you were able to kind of piece that together?
I was able to piece it together myself. Yeah, we were never really a family that talked about money. And there are a lot of families that are out there like that. And it just, that was just our family. And it was pretty evident that things were challenging, you know. I never had the greatest toys or the greatest bike or greatest clothes and those types of things. And I really got my first job when I was 13 years old to be able to help, because if I wanted nice school clothes, I bought them myself. If I wanted baseball cards or comic books or whatever it was, or whatever what was going on at that time, I was able to pay for it myself because I worked Saturday mornings. I worked all day Saturday with my uncle and earned money. So I had money to spend throughout the course of the week and buy the things that I needed and wanted. And that's maybe where my work ethic to this day comes from, is those early experiences. But it was pretty evident that things were tough.
You know, I think that part of the reason that I love these conversations so much is because I study human behavior for a living, and I know how important those formative years are in the way that people program and understand what it is they're capable of and their values and their worth and all of those things. And I also grew up in a house where we didn't talk about money. What I didn't know at the time, and I think what most parents don't know, is that they think that they're protecting their kids by not talking about money. What they don't understand, though, is that your little 6, 7, 8-year-old brain is going to make up a story about why you don't have the same things that your friend down the street has. And that story is almost never the actual truth. It's almost never, mom and dad love me and they're doing everything that they can for me. It's, I don't deserve to have these things. I'm not worth having success. I'm all of these things. And when I work with people, I stay out of numbers. When I work with people about money mindset, one of the first conversations that we have is, what were your first memories about money? What were your first conversations about it? So for you, did you ever have this moment where you realized that you had to shift what you believed you were capable of having related to money based upon your experiences as a kid? And how do you think that would have been different if your parents would have talked to you about money and what the possibilities were?
It's a great question. I've told the story a number of times. Nobody's ever asked that type of question. I appreciate it. I think, first off, going back to your comments about, you know, some of that self-talk, right, that we have with ourselves with some of these experiences. I remember if they didn't have to worry about me, then maybe that's what prompted me to try to find work early on and try to find ways to earn money. That way it was kind of like this, you know, if I can take the pressure off of them, maybe things will get better for everybody, you know. And I think I carried that weight for a long period of time. But I think the shift really came, you know, probably, if I look back, I probably carried that weight for a long, long time. I would say I probably didn't recognize this as well as I should have, like, probably until I was like maybe the mid 20s, you know, 24, 25, 26, somewhere in that range, where I was like, okay, like, I'm headed in the right direction. Things are like, I'm trying to do all the right things. Like, here are the steps I need to take. I went back to school and finished my degrees late. I took a couple of years off, which turned into like 4 years off after my first couple of years of college, and moved to California. And I just basically hustled out here and did what I could to stay in California. And I really didn't appreciate, you know, that experience, I don't think, until I was probably later in life, like 26, 27, somewhere in that range. But yeah, I mean, it's not something that I think I would have carried. Had they spent more time talking about it and been a little more open and honest, and this is not their fault, they were very young parents, I probably would have looked at things a little bit different. I probably would have taken less responsibility and felt like less of, you know, this is, I wouldn't say my fault, but I would have recognized that it wasn't up to me to help them get through it. It was up to me to be a kid.
Yeah. And I don't know that there's anything, you know, I think about this often when I'm looking back and wondering if my parents would have talked to me about money, would my financial situation have been different? And frankly, I don't know that they didn't try. Like, there are things that we just don't want to hear when we're a kid, and sitting down and learning how to like balance a checkbook is one of them. So I say this question with all the love of knowing that my parents tried to talk to me about a lot of things that I didn't care about when I was a kid. I also know that the touchier the subject is, the more uncomfortable the conversation, the more that we avoid it. And if we're not allowed to talk about something, then there must be a reason for it. And just like all other things that make us anxious, the reason we create is almost always worse than the reason that actually exists.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, they don't teach you this stuff in school. It's not up to our parents all the time to teach us everything that they should be. We were sent off to school to get an education, and instead I learned how to like play badminton. That was my experience with high school. I don't remember any of it except that I learned how to play a lot of different sports, because I feel like all I ever did was I was in gym. Like, it's like they don't teach you how to balance a checkbook, like you said, and do all.
No, and they should, and I don't know why they don't. And I'm not about to try to understand or fix or solve the education system. How though are we in this century, this year, and we aren't having conversations about the actual skills that people need to learn in college? I mean, or even in high school. I appreciate the history aspect of knowing where we came from and being able to really lean on that. But when are the practical skills going to start to come into play? So, and I know that this is not a conversation that's new to you, because you probably, well, you don't probably, you live in this world. So for you, these are frustrations that you deal with on a much larger scale than the conversations that we have around a dinner table. So, what was it? And you mentioned your parents, so that might've been the answer, but I want to clarify, what was it that made you decide that you wanted to spend your time making sure families were secure in relationship to their money?
Yeah, I feel like there are certain jobs out there that they're really noble, and they have a significant impact with not a lot, I shouldn't say not a lot of effort, but you know, not a lot of effort. And one of them is the work that we do as a, as financial planners, right? Like, what's most important aside from your loved ones, and maybe religion, what are the most important things to most people? Health and money.
Yeah.
And I don't do blood and guts. I don't understand chemistry. I'm not a science guy. My wife is a nurse, and I let her handle the blood and gut stuff. And like, if I get a splinter, it's, you know, I'm ready to pass out. So there's also the overlay of business, and kind of, you know, dealing with business in general. You deal with a lot of finance and accounting and that type of thing. So I kind of gravitated to the money side of things. But I think, you know, it's a very noble job that we do. And that's why I dedicated my career to it, right? Like I didn't just go to want to become a financial planner. I wanted to be a certified financial planner and then take the extra education and spend another year and a half studying for a very gnarly exam to be able to get that designation, right?
Yeah.
And that's why going into the certified divorce financial analyst realm, I didn't want to just help people navigate the financial aspects of divorce. I wanted to be a certified person that does that and make sure I had the proper education to guide people through it. So, yeah, I mean, I obviously, you know, the situation with my parents was a big impact, but I tried, when I looked out over like the things I wanted to do with my life or what I could do with my life. Like, I mean, I've worked with probably 1800 households in my career. That's pretty good work, I think.
Yeah. How often are you able to get in front of people at the good part, the honeymoon stage of their relationship before the divorce analyst comes into play? Because I can imagine that people hear certified divorce financial analyst and they think, I am never going to need you, shoe fly. And then they do. And they're like, man, I wish I would have talked to you earlier. Kind of like the kid parent conversation we were just having. So how often are you able to get in front of people early enough for it to matter before it needs to matter?
Luckily a lot, because I have two different companies, right? So we have our traditional financial planning company that I set up about 4 years ago now, Woodson Wealth Management. And we do retirement planning, investments, and, you know, insurance, estate planning, the traditional stuff, right? The traditional wealth management stuff. And then I have the divorce financial planning company that we set up as a separate entity, just so that we're not blurring the lines between the type of work that we're doing and we avoid conflicts. And the beauty of that, like from the majority of my career in that role in the traditional financial planning realm, there are a lot of those experiences. You know, we had five Woodson Wealth babies last year. Two marriages. We've had several new businesses that people have started. All the fun stuff, right? Like all the stuff that like wow, this is all awesome. Like. And we deal with the younger crowd too. So we deal with people that are somewhere between the age of like 30 and 50. So we're not dealing with retirees. So I've kind of left the world of having to deal with death and dying and those, which is the earlier part of my career. So now we get all the cool stuff, right? So I'm lucky enough to have that experience, but it's not always that way. And having the experience that I do on the divorce side now, I can help people navigate that and start preparing for it early on in their relationships. And you and I were talking about this leading up to, you know, starting to hit the record button about prenups and things of that nature, having those conversations now and setting the stage for it, because let's face it, 50% of divorces end in marriage. So even though it's happy-go-lucky right now, it doesn't always end that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think societally, and this is something that after becoming an attorney and then deciding to transition out of the full-time practice of law that I'm more passionate about than ever, I think as a society, the idea that we need to decide what we're going to do when we grow up, when we're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, we need to decide who we're going to marry and spend the rest of our life with when we're 18. We need to decide everything is permanent. Every decision is permanent. And it's just not the way life is. And it creates this shame around something not working out, your business not working out. I was just talking to somebody the other day and they were talking about how they had a couple of experiences with suicide when they were young. And when it was described to him why they had taken their own life, it was because their business failed. There's so much shame around something not lasting forever that we don't know how to handle it. And so this idea of believing in success and planning the parachute in case you're about to hit the ground is so important to me, and knowing that it's okay to pull it. I mean, I would never tell somebody when to pull the trigger on their relationship or their career. They need to know it's okay to do it, though, if it's necessary.
Absolutely. And that's, I wish there was less stigma around this whole prenup thing.
Me too.
Right. I mean, it's, you are going into a business transaction. Let's just face it. You know, you may love the person and you may be soulmates and all this other stuff. And it's rainbows and butterflies. I get it. You know, I get it. I really do. But it is a business transaction. Agreed. You are the CEO of your life and this person is the CEO of their life. And you're trying to merge those businesses together. right? There's a financial situation over here, his finances over here, there's baggage, there's all this like stuff that goes on. And when we, in order to get married, you know, at least, well, I'm in California and I know you're in Nevada, so it's roughly the same process. You have to have a license to get married. You walk into the county recorder's office, you file the documents. It's a business transaction.
Yep. And in Vegas, I don't know if you guys have these yet. In Vegas, you don't even have to get out of your car.
Like, no, drive-through.
We have drive-through. Yeah, you can.
You don't have to drive. We don't have drive-through.
Yeah. Yeah. Elvis will marry you in the back of your car.
We don't have a drive through chapel, but it's the same. It's true though. So we put the stigma around this legal contract, which is really nothing more than a, hey, if this doesn't work out, let's just talk about how this is going to go down and save ourselves some headaches, because I don't want to take you to court. I don't want you to take me to court. I don't want to spend a bunch of money on attorneys, no offense. Right. But why is
I don't
it
want
so
to spend
weird?
Any money on attorneys, and I am one.
No. Why is it so weird?
I
stop
know.
Stop making it weird.
Are you seeing more and more people, I'm going to say go against tradition, although I don't think it's tradition anymore. Are you seeing more and more people keep their finances and their lives separate and then come together to find places where they intersect but keep everything separate?
Absolutely. There's a lot more of this is my money, this is your money, and this is our money, which I didn't see. I didn't see that a lot in the early phase of my career, but in the last, you know, call it 10 years or so, I see that a lot more these days. And I think it's super smart. Super smart.
Me too. It's interesting because I practice immigration law and I practice criminal defense and immigration. In the world of immigration law, when somebody gets married and they want a petition for their significant other, one of the ways that they show the validity of their relationship is joint assets and joint bank accounts. And we're seeing more and more people choose not to get joint bank accounts. And as society has evolved, immigration has had to figure out how to judge love and valid relationships because they can't. And so it's interesting to see the law try to catch up when gauging things like, is a relationship valid when society, and the prenup comes into this too, because I have people come to me and say, can we get a prenup and still be able to go through this immigration process? And my answer is always, absolutely. We just need to explain it because that's where society's at right now. I want to protect my stuff.
Absolutely.
So how do you start, you know, the person that's listening to this podcast, maybe we've touched a chord when it comes to the relationship side of things. Maybe they're about to get married. I should send this to my brother. Maybe they're about to get married and they're making the decision to get a prenup or not. Maybe they're deciding to start a business. And a lot of times when we do any of those things, we are so focused on the decisions that are right in front of us that the money decisions of what the big organizational structure is going to look like is the last conversation when it really should be the first. What are things that people should be thinking about in relation to their personal and professional finances that they might not have already been aware of?
I think the first thing is to leverage resources that are available. And I'm biased here, but there are a lot of financial planners out there like myself that can help you navigate some of those early decisions. We do a lot of business consulting. You know, I have several clients that are business owners themselves. I have a husband and wife that started a franchise last year that we've helped them navigate some of the early stages of that. And whether it's, you know, leveraging a financial planner or leveraging a good CPA to help on the tax side of things or leveraging someone, you know, an attorney, what have you. It may sound like, even though you're starting this entity and it may seem like, wow, this is a gigantic expense that I have to, you know, we don't have any revenue coming in. So how can I spend the money on getting that fund, professional support? I've seen some things over the years where something will come up, you know, a year or two or five down the road that they didn't anticipate in those early stages that could have been avoided had they just taken a pause, mm-hmm. just take a step back. And make sure that you're doing this the right way. Or do you have the right corporate structured? Are you, should you, you know, S corporation versus a C corporation versus an LLC or an LLP or whatever it is. Like, you have to make the right decisions on early on. Otherwise it can come back to bite you later. And there are resources available. You just have to know where to find them and leverage them.
Yeah. How do you advise people to make sure that all of those pieces are talking to each other? Because there's not one person that can do all of those things. And yet the pieces, the spokes of the wheel, need to talk to each other. So what is the advice you have for making sure that everybody knows what's going on?
Same thing we talk about in divorce cases. It's creating team you, right? You're trying to create team you. You want a good tax person, a good legal person over here, and you have, you know, good advisors around you. It can make all the difference. And, you know, if I use the example of divorce, right? If you have a good financial person to help you on the financial aspect of things, you have a good attorney to help you on the legal aspect of things, or maybe even a divorce coach. There are a lot of divorce coaches out there that can help you navigate the legal hurdles that you're going to have to jump through in whatever state you're in. You don't always have to pick up the phone and call an attorney to help you through this stuff. There are divorce coaches out there that can help you with it, and a good therapist, right?
Yeah.
Like, having those three people in place to be able to help you manage the financial, the legal, and the emotional aspects of things, you're probably going to be in a much better place when the divorce is finalized, mentally, emotionally, you know, physically, financially, than not having created that team you. It's the same way with business, right? And so we have an amazing tax person. We have a tax attorney that I hired to make sure that we're not jamming anything up on the tax side of things. We have a great bookkeeping team, and, you know, it's just, you have to do it. They're necessary expenses. It hurts to write the check, don't get me wrong, especially in the early stages of this when we have very little revenue coming in and almost no clients, starting from zero.
Hurts a lot less than that letter from the IRS, though.
Oh, man.
My number one goal, actually, I have two. My number two goals in life are, number one, never to hear from the IRS, and number two, never to hear from the state bar. If I can do those two things, I've accomplished my goal. So now's kind of the flip side of the equation. I think that we all know that person out there who has been burned by the financial advisor that went to the weekend course and then got told that they could sell life insurance and investments. And they lump all financial advisors into that same field. So what are things that people should be looking for to make sure that they have the right financial advisor on their side? And what are some red flags that should immediately cause them to say, wait a minute, maybe we need to talk?
The very first place that everyone should go when they're hiring a financial planner is FINRA's broker check, FINRA, the Financial Regulatory Authority. FINRA has a website called Broker Check. And every one of us that has a license to do this business and has a company set up to do this type of business, all of our information is in there. We have to education, experience, disclosures that you want to be aware of. And I actually put this up on Instagram, or I made an Instagram video about this, you know, months back, because I saw some things on LinkedIn where this one advisor was just posting all kinds of garbage stuff, and it was like not even accurate. And now people are going to TikTok to get their financial advice. It's just laughable. So I made this video, and I'm like, go to Broker Check and put in my first name, my last name, you can see my experience, all my credentials, the series licenses that I have, and so on. And if there are any disclosures in there, that's something you want to talk, you know, to the advisor about and bring up in conversation. Let them speak to it. Now, and a disclosure is not the end of the world. People make mistakes, people get misdemeanors, and they get a traffic ticket, and next thing you know, they forget about it, and it's has to go on their record for 10 years, whatever it is. But yeah, you know, there are some, I've seen some crazy things, and these guys and gals are still in business, and they should not be. And people are handing over, people are giving them their money left and right, because they're not checking background.
It's true. And you know what's crazy is the, you know, going from the legal industry to the coaching world, the hardest thing for me to get used to was that there wasn't a regulatory authority for the coaching world. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. What I do think, though, is in a world where people can market themselves really well on social media, you need something more than the PR that they've paid for to make a determination of whether they're a good fit for you. And so I love that you mentioned FINRA. I didn't know that they did that, which is incredibly valuable. The last thing that we need is somebody avoiding a conversation with a good financial planner because they've been approached by five bad ones.
Absolutely. It happens all the time. And, you know, these, and then you got those, all these people out there with these steak dinners and selling and pitching all this. Oh man, it's gotten bad over the course of the last, you know, decade or so. And they're a lot of these, you know, not so great advisors are, you know, making the rest of us look bad, but I think if anybody's going to do their research on anybody, that's the first place I would go. Just check it out, do your homework, and probably save yourself some headaches.
I love that. When somebody is, you know, a couple things, actually. First of all, I love that you mentioned a divorce coach. I learned that this was a thing for the first time about 6 months ago. And I fell in love with this person immediately because I know some fantastic family law attorneys. I also know some attorneys who bill hourly and get really frustrated when shit's already worked out when they come to them. Like, you could get so much more. And then this amicable divorce is blown to shreds because an attorney wants to bill hourly. So I love the divorce coach idea, especially because of the emotions that are involved, especially if you have kids. What's your take on the financial side of that same conversation? The financial, like, mindset coach conversation, and how does that work in conjunction with what you do or contrary to what you do?
Well, I would concur with what you said earlier about attorneys as well and their and billing habits. And I say that with all due respect because I have a estate planning and family law attorney on my wealth management team. And I have one of my best friends who was at my wedding is a family law attorney and got me through my divorce himself. So all due respect, but I encourage people to try to get through that process without having to pick up a phone and call an attorney as the first call.
Right? Yeah.
And I, to your point, I in the last few years, I just recently learned about divorce coaches. I got divorced 7 years ago. I had no idea that these people existed.
Yeah,
me neither. I probably would have had so much more success and done things differently earlier on had I just relied on the attorney to do it, because they get busy and they don't understand the financial aspects of things, so they're trying to figure it out too, and they're, you know, and you're, every time they're figuring it out, you're paying them to figure it out. So that's where, you know, people like us and divorce coaches come in. But what I've seen with the coaches is we can usually get people through the process without having to, or maybe even using an attorney as more of a consultant, right? So there are attorneys out there that will allow you to pay them a smaller retainer, and you can just, you know, send your paperwork. Give them a call, say, hey, I got to file this document, or I have to send this response in. Can you take a look at the documents? They sign off on it, and you move on. But if you're willing to do some of the work, you can save yourself a ton of cash. And The one thing I would say with even with the divorce coaches, though, in my experience so far, they're very good at helping with things like navigating the emotional side of divorce, and helping with parenting plans, helping with what are some things you want to consider? What are you going to add? You know, some of the negotiations and thinking through some of the things that are important relative to mediation and what have you. But really, where they, I don't know that, in my experience, that they've been that great on the financial side of things. It's just not in their wheelhouse.
Yeah. That's agree. My experience so far. And I think what's so interesting and why it's so important to have somebody there is, as an attorney, I can speak firsthand that my job before I became a coach was not to work you through the emotional trauma of this event. And I realized that I missed that. I realized that by being so smart in the law that I had become almost unhuman when it came to emotion and connection. And people would come in and I would honestly say to them, you don't pay me to get emotionally involved in your case. You pay me for facts. Well, the problem is, you know, I deal with people who are about to go to prison for the rest of their life or get deported. People that do family law deal with people that are about to lose their kids. All three of those are such emotional areas of law. And especially in the divorce realm, I can't tell you how many times I have people ask me for a divorce attorney and they're like, I want somebody who's going to make my wife pay. Or my husband pay. And I'm like, you should want somebody who's going to protect you and your kids. Like, so that vindictiveness when you feel like you've been hurt is where I think a divorce coach becomes incredibly helpful in avoiding the catastrophe that comes after decision making.
Yeah. I mean, and folks like, you know, so folks like you and I, we operate mostly on the IQ side of things, right? Mm-hmm. We deal with the emotional piece is where the divorce coach comes in, and we have a very tough job as an attorney and as somebody like myself. We have to sometimes bring ourselves over to the EQ side of the conversation and recognize, like, okay, this is like they're going through it. How do we quell their nerves, calm their concerns, and help them chill out a little bit, but also get the job done at the same time. So it's a delicate balance, and I can appreciate that. That's why I say all the time, like you are now the CEO of your life. You have to be very pragmatic, and you have to be, you know, one word answers and emails and very, very short, you know, text messages. And every time you want to communicate with the ex-spouse, you've got to rein in that emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. Because there are 1,000 times in my own divorce where I'm like, oh my God, I just want to send this text message. Like, oh, this is like ridiculous.
The bubble.
Don't get me wrong. I sent a few of them that I wish I could take back these days. But, you know, there will maybe a time when you will see that text message on the screen in the court of law and you're going to have to speak to it. So you better be careful. And so
the crazy thing now is actually there's programs that courts, when there's an allegation of some sort of harassment, there's programs that the courts can force you to communicate through where they can monitor all of the communication between the two of you. So, I mean, not that they can't monitor it on your phone because privacy is an illusion.
I know talking parents is one of them. And I think if you have to, I have experience with it in my own divorce, and it saved the day a lot of times.
Yeah. So if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking, I really like the approach, because I will say that what I've enjoyed about this conversation the most is the human outcome that you work so hard to create. I think dealing with families adds an additional layer of a necessity to be aware of the emotional side of it that dealing with individuals doesn't. So if somebody's listening to this and saying, I want somebody who understands the human side of my money and how to make it work for me, what is the best way for them to reach out to you?
I think they can just have them visit the website. I'm sure we'll put up the links when this post, but you can visit the wealth management website is woodsonwm.com, woodsonwm.com. All of my contact information is in there. There's a link to our divorce planning company, which is called Allegiant Divorce Solutions. And so either one of the websites would be perfectly fine. I try to be, you know, on social media as much as I possibly can and active there, and we're growing our audience there, so they can, you know, check us out on Instagram or what have you. And we also started a Facebook group just a short while ago called Preparing Financially for Divorce. And I think we have almost 200 members in just a few weeks. So it's growing pretty rapidly. And I'm just going to, there's no sales. It's not spammy. We're not promoting anything. It's literally like every day I'm trying to provide tips and tricks to help people navigate this, because I've been there. You know, I've been there, and it's not easy, but.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I know when I got divorced, we didn't have any kids. We didn't own anything. My marriage was short-lived. And I remember even without the emotional attachment of little humans and things, I wanted out so badly that I adopted all of the debt from the relationship. Like I just did everything myself. And I remember people looking at me saying, you know, Amber, like he should share some of this. And my thought was, I'm willing to take it on to restart my life. And I wish that I would have had somebody on the other side that could have like smacked me out of that and been like, listen, think about your future, right? Like, luckily we were young and only married for a year. So how much debt can you rack up in a year? And still, it's so necessary. So we're going to go ahead and throw all of those links in the show notes. It has been so fantastic to have you here. I think that, like I said before, you just bring a human element to finances that I haven't heard in a really long time. And that's refreshing.
Well, I appreciate that so much. It was great being here and having this conversation with you. Let's do it again.
Yes, we'll make it happen.